Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
Whereas the modern, traditional classroom typically has a focal point, a central figure or purpose, let's imagine a classroom with multiple centers and shared leadership. We learn in such a space that the world is multi-perspectival. For example, someone who thrives in one context may need help in another. Those who might be considered at risk can have much to share and teach if they can find the proper context to access their gifts. A learning space that is shaped physically with multiple centers can also be a space for a diversity of ideas. We are confronted with challenges that are largely caused by our conventional patterns of thought, and therefore the solutions require new patterns and ideas. To do so, it requires us to recognize that each individual brings a unique and valuable perspective. For example, a teacher may have a master's degree, and that knowledge and experience is valuable and should be honored by the student. But a student may also bring a range of experiences, a veritable PhD in their own life that should also be honored. Lastly, each individual is diverse in that they possess a range of qualities that make up a whole person. A complete learning process involves each aspect of the human, not just the intellectual. Moreover, getting to know oneself involves a recognition of this internal diversity, even when we are confronted with contradictions. The self can at once embody contradictory elements. Embracing the paradoxical nature of ourselves is a pathway to self-acceptance and compassion for others. Danielle Dupuis, she, her, is a library media specialist and video production teacher at a public school in Maryland. A good portion of her work revolves around meeting the needs of students and teachers through technology, resources, and books. She enjoys collaborating, learning new things, and finding ways to bring visibility and acceptance to the LGBTQ+ community through her daily work. As a creative, Danielle has co-authored 4 professional resource books for educators and has dreams of becoming a published children's and young adult author. Danielle and her family live in the Baltimore area and enjoy taking hikes and exploring new adventures together. Her free time is spent reading, writing, and enjoying the company of friends. Danielle Dupuis, welcome to Reimagining.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So I wanted to enter into this conversation by framing it in context, maybe both in terms of the history a little bit and also how things are going in present. And if you could talk a little bit, familiarize people and to provide some context, like paint a picture for us of what some of the challenges and struggles there have been for queer youth in school.
Currently or in the past?
Well, let's start with the past. Like historically, what's that been like? For someone, maybe it doesn't have any context for that.
All right. So I'll rewind a little bit. I've been working at my high school right now for, gosh, it's been, I think, 14 years. And then prior to that, I was in elementary. And then even before that, I was in the public library. And as a public librarian, I had an opportunity at one point to bring Brent Hartinger to a school in Howard County. And he was so kind and so wonderful with the kids, but there really wasn't any sort of vibe for queer kids in that space. So bringing him, it felt a little awkward because only a handful of kids showed up, you know, for this author, who I felt was a pretty big name author at the time for the Geography Club. Like that was kind of like a groundbreaking book, I felt like, for queer kids to be able to have access to. And I had felt ties with the book because as a young person, when I was in high school, I was part of a key club, which is Junior Kiwanis, essentially. And so mm-hmm. We did a lot of service projects, and it was almost like a disguise for basically queer club, because the three of the officers, we were all gay, and you know, it was a great place to feel welcome and be together without people really knowing who we are necessarily. And so the book resonated with me because it's basically about a club that they're called the Geography Club, but it ends up being more of a LGBTQ GSA club, essentially.
Right.
And so being able to bring that author to this school for a talk was so awesome. But then there was only like four or five kids that came. And I think it's because kids just didn't feel comfortable, or they felt like, you know, well, I don't want to be part of a group that reads books that might be considered queer, or it felt very stifling a little bit. And for me, once I graduated with my master's and then became a media specialist, I was pretty quiet about who I was, just because I wasn't sure how things would be accepted. I can say that, I'm sorry, I kind of skip around a little bit here because I know
it's okay.
The future questions and things, so I don't want to go too far. But as a teen, for me, it was always so challenging. I had come out of the closet when I was a teenager, and then it wasn't really received very well. And so I kind of retreated back in the closet. And so I think that was a challenge for me. There wasn't really a LGBTQ club. There weren't queer books. There were no rainbow flags that were super visible. The only place that I felt welcome was when you could go to a club as like a teenager. You know, you get the little X on your hand saying that you couldn't drink or whatever, but you would go to a gay club. That was the only place where you could be visible and you could be seen and be with other people who were like you that were, you know, out, but they were only really out when they were at the club. It's just kind of like, you know, you're out and you're at the club, but then when you go home, you kind of go back in the closet a bit because you're not accepted by everyone else.
Right.
You know, so for me and small, very small group of friends from my school, that's what we would do. And then I also remember going to Lambda Rising. It was a bookstore in Baltimore City, and we would drive there, and they had a group that met above the bookstore occasionally, and it was other queer youth. And so it was a support group, and a couple of us got together and went to that a few times too, but it wasn't super feasible because I didn't live in Baltimore City. I had to wait until I had availability for the car, or wait for my friend of mine to have availability of his car, and then we would go together. So it wasn't very accessible, but it was nice because then you were with other kids who were, you know, other youth that were having kind of going through the same things that you were. And it was comforting to know that you weren't alone.
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. It seems like historically, anyway, there were certain pockets. You mentioned having to go into Baltimore City, there's certain pockets in which one could find acceptance. Mm-hmm. But if you weren't in one of those pockets, it could be a really different experience.
Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have the privilege of having access to a car, I wouldn't have been able to do those things. You know, but I think historically there's been a need to stay, in some cases, stay hidden just for safety purposes, depending on the comfort level of the person or how accepted you are in the community. There was a lot of rumors at my school when I was, even in middle school, I knew who I was probably late elementary, middle school. I didn't know what it was. I didn't have a name for it, but I mean, I knew I was different. And I had like milk thrown at me and called a lesie or whatever they called me. And there was a conversation in like gym class. And, you know, so I felt, I mean, I guess you would call it bullying. It was a little bit of harassment, a little bullying, and it was just very uncomfortable. So I tried to stay quiet, or sometimes it would make me really angry and other times super depressed. So it was definitely a struggle. I think that in the present, currently, you know, kind of going from back then to now, the changes that I've seen, it's been an interesting perspective being an educator, because I'm still in the school building. I mean, I couldn't wait to get out of middle school. I hated middle school. I hated high school. So getting out of those situations and now being a high school educator is kind of ironic in a lot of ways. But it does give me a little perspective on how much change has actually happened in that time frame of 30 years.
I'm interested in your take on this, you know, because it's my experience of it, you know, having gone to say high school in the late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. was that in an urban environment, certainly not, you know, a rural environment, you know, was that there was absolutely no acceptance of queer youth in mm-hmm. in my experience. It would have not only uncomfortable, but potentially dangerous to come out in those times. My children have no sense of that at all. growing up and to be fair, in a pretty progressive liberal urban area, right?
Right.
But it does seem and feel really different to me from those days. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the pushback and some of the things that are not going well, but it is a little bit different from the way it was, say, even 20 years ago.
Oh, for sure. It's different from 10 years ago and 5 years ago. I mean, everything is changing at such a rapid pace. It's hard to keep up in some ways. What I can say is that I feel like at present, unfortunately, I mean, even in being in the progressive situation that we're in a really progressive county, kids are still hearing the slurs all the time. Kids are still getting bullied, not being accepted. And I think that's always going to be the challenge when you have people that aren't willing to have other viewpoints or aren't willing to be accepting of all people. Even in communities, like there's still prejudice within communities, you know, where you think that, oh, you know, there wouldn't be any prejudice there, but no, there is. And so I think it's one of the hardest things is when you have kids that try to come out and then don't feel safe and then have to retreat back. And once you go back to the closet, it's even harder to come back a second time or a third time because, you know, you don't want to have to repeat that trauma or that feeling on acceptance, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that would be hard for anyone at any age to endure that kind of cruelty. But when you're talking about adolescence, essentially, and, you know, for the most part, which is a time of period in one's life when acceptance by peers is crucially important.
Absolutely.
You know, developmentally. So it's kind of like a double challenge. You're looking for acceptance, not just from adults, I mean, but from your peers. And that can be just a really traumatic time, I think, for a young person.
Yeah. And as an adult, you know, I can switch schools. I could go to try something else, find
That's
a new
right.
friend group. But
yeah,
when you're
yeah.
constantly going to the same school where your bullies are, even if you change classes, you're going to see them
too.
Oh, yeah.
Know, and so with social media, it can be even more challenging with that.
Yeah. It's just morphed from, you know, I used to get phone calls from kids just being mean, you know, just calling my house. And they had enough guts that, you know, when my mom answered the phone to ask for, oh, can we, you know, is Danielle there? You know, can Danielle talk or whatever? And my mom's like, hey, you know, the phone's for you. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and you get the phone and it's like, oh, it's somebody from school. Okay, cool. You know, I got a friend, right? And it's not a friend. Like on the other end, it's just like somebody calling you a dyke and yelling at you into the phone and then laughing hysterically before hanging up. And it's just like, you know, and then you're just left there with, holy crap. In the span of like 10 seconds, you had like this major uplift, like somebody's calling, it's a friend, to holy crap, I feel like the lowest of the low. So I think it's just transition from those phone calls. Now we have social media and people can infiltrate your inbox or your social media. And it's just, it's just awful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really hard. I want to sort of expand that out a little bit into the kind of current climate in the country at large, you know? But we've got incredible progress that we talked about. Things are changing. Perceptions are changing generally, but then there's pushback too. Right. And it's pushback in the form, not just of kind of on a micro level of kids being mean, but there's also pushback on the broader level of actual laws being written, like the one recently in Florida. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd like your take on that a little bit. Like, how do you see the climate of the country? I mean, do you think it's a sort of temporary pushback here at the progress by kind of reactionary forces? Or do you see it as something that's a more kind of like broader push to the right in the country? How do you see that?
I think that every time we are on the right path, we're going to get that pushback. And I think that we're getting closer and closer and closer to having a little bit more equity, having a little bit more acceptance. And as we get closer to those things, there's always going to be a small group of people that are going to show their hatred and share that with the world. And I don't want, yes, it's horrible and it's disgusting and it is a letdown. It's very disappointing. But at the same time, I don't want to lose sight on the prize. And the prize is that I can be out, you know, I can be out. I can live my life with my family. And I want that for everybody. You know, I want everybody to feel comfortable and live authentically without fear of repercussion. And I think that if we in the places that are being progressive, if we can continue to be visible, if we can continue to advocate, that we'll be able to kind of show others the right path. I always think that every time this kind of stuff comes up, there is a political agenda, unfortunately. Sure. You know, somebody wants to get into office. Okay, let me show those people that I know I can feed into their hatred and their fear. Let me show those people that are fearful that I am going to put a stop to this by coming up with this bill. That's what's happening. It's people that are fearful. Oh, they don't want to have people, you know, in schools talking about sex, or they don't want to have people talking about gender in school. What is so concerning? You know, I don't understand. Like, is it really so terrible that my kids have two moms? They can't talk about their family in school. You can't have a discussion about it. I think it's kind of cool when you get to learn about other people's family situations, you know, like, oh, cool. You live with a grandma, your grandparents raised you. Okay. Those are your parents. That's awesome. Or you're in a foster family. Okay. Let's talk about that, you know, or if there's something that the kids want to share, if they're sharing that, then they want to talk about it. No, we don't need to pry. We don't need to ask. But if they are feeling safe enough in your classroom to be able to share that information, isn't that wonderful? I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, so do I. It seems to me that, like, in general, whether we're talking about a queer kid or some kind of different family structure, or or simply talking about sexuality and sex in a way that's healthy and uplifting and celebratory, rather than instilling shame,
right?
Which is, I think, what a lot of all of this does, is instill shame. And shame is a pathway to all kind of bad outcomes, you know? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that rather than doing that, we ought to just encourage people to have honest conversations and not feel ashamed of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation.
Awesome.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions, rather it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
So I'm speaking with Danielle Dupuis today, and we were talking about the progress as well as the pushback that queer youth have gotten in terms of what's going on in schools and in the culture more broadly. Danielle, will you share with us a little bit about your feeling on that?
So I kind of wanted to add a little bit about kind of the pushback, even in my own small progressive community. We've had a lot of book challenges this year. I've been a media specialist for a couple decades now, working in libraries, and I have never, ever seen the amount of challenges that I've seen in this year. Sometimes there may be one challenge in a year. Sometimes it's one challenge every 2 years. We've had 9 books challenged just this school year. And so that's a lot. And it was a trickle down from people get a hold of a book, they flip through it. Oh, this this book looks interesting. Oh, let me flip through and I see this sentence says this, and I'm going to post it out on the internet and let everybody know how horrible this book is because it says this. It's like, you know, and then upon further investigation, you find out the person's never read the book. They, right. You know, all these people that all of a sudden get all wound up in hatred over this title, and they have no idea why. They just want to join the bandwagon of like, okay, let's, you know, this book is gay and let's get rid of it. And it's
just interesting because I suspect that some of these people have read the Bible in the same way, like completely decontextualized, picking out random sentences. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. What, for sure. You know, 100%.
What, so can you give me an example? I'm like really interested in like an example of something that's particularly egregious. You know, it's hard for me to envision what would be so horrible you'd want to ban it. So do you have an example of something that you felt like was really
sure,
egregious?
Yes.
Or even like the subject that it was about? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So there is a book, and this is just goes to show you how ridiculous this book is. So, or not the book, but how ridiculous the situation is.
Yeah.
So
yeah, sure.
There's a book called Lawn Boy by Jonathan Evison. And there's also a book called Lawn Boy by Gary Paulsen. Now, you might be familiar with Gary Paulsen, wrote Hatchet, you know, yeah, a classic, yeah, or whatever. Well, people found out that there was a scene in Lawn Boy that discussed, as soon as books get challenged, I'm interested in reading them because I want to know why people are challenging them.
Right, right.
And so I read Lawn Boy by Jonathan Evison, and I thought it was a great book. It was very interesting. And one of the piece that stood out to me that people were absolutely enraged about was actually about a young man recounting a time when he was younger and there was a situation between him and an older man. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there people are up in arms about how this is so awful that somebody would promote sexual content with a minor and what have you. And I'm like, whoa, 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 wait a second. What you just did there was basically discount every person that's ever been abused as a child.
Right.
Because obviously that could be a situation that somebody could work through by reading that book. You know, so they weren't, that book was not promoting that at all. What it was doing was helping somebody work through a difficult situation where it was a conversation between two young men about something that had happened to him previously, you know, as a younger person. And, you know, so I applauded the author for kind of addressing that issue because I feel like it's something that's swept under the rug and it's never discussed, you know, like, right. Oh, because it's an awkward topic and it's an unfortunate topic, but unfortunately it happens. And it's so traumatic for kids to kind of keep that inside and not have a way to talk about it because you have people up in arms like that, that are talking about it as disgusting. And so then that child then feels disgust for themselves, even though that wasn't their fault that happened to them. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Just for how ridiculous it was, Gary Paulsen's book, Lawn Boy, started getting all of these horrible reviews about what a disgusting and terrible book it was. He's like, what the heck are you, you know, people are like, what are you talking about? Like, this isn't even the book. So they didn't even have any idea. Not only had they not read the book, did they not know the information, but they didn't even have the correct book and correct author when they were writing these hateful reviews. It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. So in situations like that, that's what I'm talking about, like absolutely ridiculousness. And it's very frustrating as a media specialist because people need these books. And as I said, as I've always said, not every book is for every person.
Yeah. I mean, that's a terrific example of the absurdity of it for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that a totally different book then starts to get bad reviews. But as you were talking, I thought of James Baldwin says that, has this wonderful quote. He says that you think that your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. And it's like, that's precisely what we're talking about here. This notion that it's actually the opposite of what people are doing in banning these books is what should be happening, because an experience like that, which is a painful experience, an experience that around which there's probably a lot of shame and hiding and not, mm-hmm, and not necessarily people telling you, and imagine being able to read about it and realizing you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And by banning the book, what you're doing is you're interfering with a person's ability to process that pain and to recognize that they're not alone. So I think it's really tragic in that way.
Yeah. And that goes for all the queer books too, you know, that's a way for kids, especially in areas that may not be progressive, to be able to see themselves reflected in literature and, you know, know that it's okay.
Yeah. And, absolutely. It's a really stark and shocking example. You know, but I think it does speak to the kind of climate that we're in which there is a lot of progress, as we talked about, but there's also pushback that's really to the point of absurdity.
Right. And I think it's, again, it's all about fear. And I think the way to kind of rise up above that is to just keep being the louder voice in the room. And we have to be, the louder voices have to be ones of love, compassion, and we have to lead by example. And we'll get there. And there's always going to be pushback, always. It doesn't matter what subject it is, there will always be pushback. But you have to stand up for what's right. And I think that right will always win in the end game, that justice will prevail.
You know, and I also want to say that in terms of, you know, the value of having different perspectives represented in literature, and this could be true in a lot of different ways, culturally or in terms of just all different experiences. But specifically, though, in terms of what we're talking about here, we're talking about the experience of being LGBTQ. It's also important, I think, for people who do not identify that way to be able to read about and learn from those experiences. Because a lot of people grew up, I mean, I can speak for myself, I didn't actually grow up around a lot of people who were openly identifying as such where I grew up. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a thing. No one talked about it, right?
Same.
And it was, some of that was just, you know, the time or whatever too, for sure. So I'd be interested in your take on how would you articulate what it is that people can learn from reading about or learning about or encountering queer experiences, right? Who don't necessarily have that experience in their own life. What do you see that is offering to people?
So my grandfather was a very wise man. He had, I don't remember exactly what year he finished school, whether it was sixth, seventh or eighth grade education, but he never made it to high school just because of the time. And, you know, he needed to go out into working and making money for the family. But he always said that if you could read, you could do anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also true of, if you can read, you can kind of really get perspective and understanding for people that are like you, but also are not like you. And so, you know, it's always interesting to me, you know, that in kind of like when I worked in the public library, they definitely tailored collections depending on the population. And so having, you know, in Howard County, it's quite a diverse population, but there's definitely pockets that have, that draw a certain groups. So like, I think it's also really, really important that not only are you representing those groups for them to see themselves, but it's important that you have the diversity of your collection everywhere in all of your branches and all of the libraries that are around us, because that's how we're going to understand. And that's how we're going to have more empathy and compassion for people that are not like us. You know, like, wow, I never really thought about things that way before. I never really understood that queer kids, you know, thought about suicide that much, you know, because they're not accepted as a regular run-of-the-mill heterosexual, you know, cisgender kid. So I think they give us a lot of new understanding and perspective about things. I know as when I was, you know, growing up, like, you know, you have your required reading in school, but I don't know. As an adult, like, I just crave like different stories that are not, where people are not exactly like me. I feel like sometimes people go down a path where they like a certain author and that's the only thing that they're going to read, you know, like, well, I will only read the next Nora Roberts, or I will only read James Patterson or what have you. And while those authors do, you know, fulfill certain things, needs and whatever, but at the same time, they're not really giving you a lot of perspective or experience on anyone other than straight white folks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What would you, if you could give, and I know this is sort of a big and open-ended question, and there's a lot of different ways you could go, but if you could sort of give advice to educators today who are, you know, maybe sympathetic, but aren't really sure about the kind of needs or challenges that might face, that queer youth in schools might face? What do you think, like, where are the areas that I think, I mean, because there's surely been a lot of progress, but what are the areas that you think educators should be aware of?
I think advice to educators is kind of owning your insecurities and kind of really looking to self-reflect and examine your current teaching practice. Like, who is not getting their needs met in the class and why? I think it's really important to be open and honest with kids about where you are and having conversations, building that trust with students. Sometimes I hear a lot too about, I've heard from Black folks or trans folks or queer folks that they're exhausted. They're tired of answering like the same questions over and over again, where people are asking them and not doing their own research and things like that. And I can understand that. But I also know, as an educator and somebody that is out and open with who I am, I do welcome people to ask me questions. I think that in general, educators are not just curious, but they want to do what's right. And sometimes they're just uncertain as to how. And when you are, let's say, a science teacher or a math teacher or an English teacher, you're really focused on your topic matter. But you also need to be aware that it's not, you're not just there to teach English. You're not just there to teach math. You're not just there to teach art. We're there as a safe space for our kids. And sometimes going home might not be a safe place for kids. It may be a very unsafe place. And we might not know that because our kids are not telling us, you know?
Sure.
So we have to work harder and in making sure that we're establishing that safe and welcome environment in our classrooms. And sometimes that requires us to be a little vulnerable. And I think that that is also a huge lesson in education, is showing kids that it's okay to be vulnerable sometimes. And it's okay to ask for help. And it's okay to not know the answer all the time. You know, sometimes with my students or with my own children, like, I'm not going to BS. I'm not going to give you an answer just so that way I can give you an answer. I will say sometimes I actually don't know that answer, but I'll find out. And then we talk about it later. You know, maybe and then let them know, what did I do to find the answer? Did I research it? Did I go, you know, on a database? Did I call somebody that was an expert? But I think whatever it is, it's important to have the conversation, and kids will respect you so much more for taking the time and putting in that little bit of extra effort. And they're going to trust you a lot more too, because of your honesty. I try not to give my personal opinion too much. I try to kind of reframe things a little bit or what have you, just to make sure that kids can better understand from all sides, not just mine.
I think that's great advice for a teacher. Everything you said, not just specific to the issues we're discussing today, but just sort of more broadly as like what it means to be a good teacher. What I've been doing in this series on reimagining education and reimagining, is the theme is reimagine the classroom. So I'm asking each of our guests in this series for this year to, and this can be answered kind of any way that you see fit, but share your vision for what you'd like to see as the classroom of the future. What would it look like for you? And this can mean everything from physically to in terms of process or practices or however you'd like to answer.
I think that what I would absolutely love to see is a way for us to be able to have hard conversations without fear of repercussion from families or administration. There has been a lot of, that one assistant principal that read the children's picture book and then was fired from the job because people didn't like the book or whatever. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. I think that I would love to see a system in which we trusted teachers to do what we do best, that we are trusted to educate students by empowering them to use information literacy, conduct research, and just be kind. Can you imagine what it would be like if we had a classroom where there's no cell phones? That's I think every teacher's pet peeve right now, right? Cell phones.
Yeah.
No fear. Every kid could come as they are and learn from where they are, and that we stopped and chose kindness every single time. I mean, like, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
That would be a wonderful place to learn.
It would be.
And yeah. Yeah. And I thank you so much for sharing with us today. And I thank you for giving me the chance to learn. Danielle Dupuis, thank you for reimagining with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.